Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Jonah Carey is on Twitter at Jonah Carey, and he joins the Bernstein and McKnight show right now on Sports Radio 670 The Score. Happy Friday, Jonah. How are you?
Good. How are you, fellas?
Wonderful. It's a beautiful day out here at the ballpark. We have had, an admission of sorts from Major League Baseball about the baseball itself being changed.
Yeah, we talked to Alan Nathan to start the show today early on. He was the chairman of the committee that looked this all over, and it's really kind of frustrating because they say, yes, the baseball is moving farther through the air, and when asked why, they said, I don't know. They really don't know.
Well, first of all, the fact that you had Alan Nathan on the show will confirm your bona fides for the rest of time with every pointy-headed person like me forever. So that's number one. But number two, I mean, yeah, and it's not – listen, that's fine that they're confirming it. But why were they being so obstinate before? It's so silly. Like, I had to come up with a media strategy and sit on this for 2 years and think about the ways in which they manipulated the baseball and didn't say anything. This is stuff that had been reported on by Ben Lindbergh and Rob Arthur and a whole bunch of other people before, namely that – you know, MLB said basically that it falls within the normal range. But the normal range is the same thing as saying that Jose Altuve and Aaron Judge are both baseball players of roughly average height. Well, okay, 5'6 to 6'8 might define the range, but you're talking about a big, big change. And that's really what's happened here with MLB is they took the baseball from, you know, something that resembled what it was in the past, and they went to Aaron Judge levels. They turned this ball into a much livelier baseball, and what the findings showed was that, you know, people are making contact and the ball's just traveling further. And there has to be an explanation. It's always been the baseball. At least now we know it. And now we'll see what happens. I don't necessarily object to lots of home runs, but I think MLB just needs to acknowledge what's happening and make an informed decision based on the data that are available.
Well, and they don't seem to have any decision process set, and unless I've missed it, unless it's kind of been buried in some of the finer points of this thing. But if they're going to restrict the range, that's one thing. But should the baseball get changed back? Do you want to have an environment like this? They've created it in the first place, whether intentionally or unintentionally, but it doesn't seem that they've really got a stance on whether it's, you know, good.
Well, I think that's an open question, right? I mean, this is an aesthetic issue more than anything. What is your favorite era of baseball? And I'm going to tell you this flat out because I'm of a certain age. I'm in my early 40s. But I really liked baseball in the 80s. I liked baseball in the 80s, and maybe it's just that's what I grew up with. But baseball in the 80s was statistically one of the most balanced eras in Major League Baseball history. In other words, it wasn't like the 60s when Sandy Koufax could have an 0.89 ERA and the mound was 80 feet high and you need a rocket launcher to hit the ball out. And it's not necessarily the height of the PED era where everybody and their mom could hit a home run, or now when everybody and their mom could hit a home run. It was in between. You had power, you had speed, you had balls in play. Balls in play are exciting. You know, if there's a line drive in the gap and the guy makes a do-or-die decision, he misses it and it goes to the wall, it could be a triple, that's super fun. And we just have less of that. We have fewer balls in play. We have guys, you know, swinging for the fences and not being worried about striking out. That's not necessarily aesthetically pleasing. But on the other hand, some people just really like bombs, right? You know, some people just dig the long ball. And so I think there's that too. So in a perfect scenario, you know, we get the batting averages up, we get the strikeouts down, maybe a little less power, and we get back to a balanced game where guys are, you know, the 20-20, 30-30 types, these athletic types who can do a little of everything, play defense, what have you. But then again, I mean, I guess we would all wish for everybody in the game to be like Mike Trout, and maybe there are only so many athletes like that in the first place, no matter what you do to the baseball.
I want to tie in something that we were talking about just previously with Ron Coomer, the radio analyst for Cubs baseball. And we were talking about the number of walks that a team had been issued and what that does to defensive concentration levels when your pitcher can't find the strike zone. And he brought up exactly what you were saying about fewer balls in play and the stagnated game. I would be very curious to know if defensive concentration can somehow be measured in this regard, whether a walk-prone pitcher is more likely to have a defense lapse behind him in any way or not, or as this era has changed, is there something to be said for the defenses, the players that can just stay present better than others? Is that measurable, or is there any way to figure out if my curiosity can be satisfied?
Well, first of all, I love that concept. And secondly, the things that I didn't necessarily know were measurable are becoming more measurable every day, which is a cool thing about baseball. You know, we used to talk about pitch framing all the time, and now we're several years into having metrics for that. I just wrote a piece for Sportsnet.ca today that talks about Josh Donaldson a lot. Josh Donaldson's positioning has changed, and he now plays more shallow than any third baseman in all of baseball. Why does he do that? Because his arm is dragged. He can't throw. He wants to make a shorter throw, but the end result is he has less range, so his defensive numbers aren't as good as they used to be. That's really cool stuff, which we would not have been able to measure exactly how many steps is he from home plate. So I wonder if we get that. Now, concentration, of course, is a mental thing, and you can't read somebody's mind, but maybe we can find a way. Maybe it's reaction time off the bat. You know, that could be one that really works well. That if we measure the same player over the course of time, as opposed to, you know, one fast guy, one slow guy, and if the same guy is concentrating less, because of something, because of his pitchers throwing a certain way or whatever, then maybe we can do that. The only thing that I'll say, though, is that we have offsets, right? The defensive concentration is certainly a thing. But on the other hand, we have a situation where, you know, defensive numbers have improved so much. Defensive scouting has improved so much. Teams are finding a way to chop down results. You know, that part of the reason for the low batting averages is not just high strikeouts. It's that shifts, and even beyond shifts, just micro shifts. The left fielder going two steps here because based on this spray chart, based on this exit velocity, we just have scouting that we never could have dreamed of. Forget about, you know, 50 years ago, even 10 years ago, we never would have thought this could happen.
Jonah, we had Kyle Schwarber on the show a little bit earlier in the day, and according to UZR 150, he's one of the best left fielders in baseball. I don't think anybody would have thought that after opening day or even the next day. I wonder how much trust you put in zone ratings early on in a season like this. And even from a, you know, you're just talking about micro-shifting point of view, do you think it's possible the Cubs have found, you know, the best three steps to the left he needs to take to put him in position? I wonder how early it is to make those assessments for a guy like Schwarber.
Yeah, I think sample size is going to play into it. We're just barely over a quarter of a season. So, you know, if he happened to have gotten a good jump on a couple balls, that, you know, a couple triples that become outs makes a big difference in terms of defensive metrics. So that's one. But I think there is something to the idea of combining pitching scouting with defense scouting. And it's something that the Cubs have notably done well. You know, they really seem to do a good job of that. They keep it under wraps, of course. But they have, you know, veteran staff and guys like when Arrieta was on the team, he showed this to some extent. Lester can do this. It's not just about blowing a guy away. It's about, I'm going to let you hit this pitch. It's going to be hit to a certain place. Now, you can't necessarily do it that it's going to be hit right at Kyle Schwarber, but you can try to put it in zones where this guy's going to throw this pitch. Schwarber's going to be ready. This guy, the batter's you know, typical range of outcomes is this, and the Cubs are trying that. They have been for years. So I think that there might be something to it that, combined with the sample size issue, could play a role. And notably, the Cubs have been one of the best defensive teams in baseball for the last several years. Part of that is having guys like Javi Baez, which is supernatural. But maybe we need to start crediting the team for some systemic success that's not just about the athleticism of the player, but really about superior scouting and analysis.
Let's play Name That Player. And I'm going to give you some numbers to make a point here. In March and April combined, this player slashed .327, .421, .735 with a weighted runs created plus of .198. In the month of May, this very same player is slashing .130, .167, and .217 with a weighted runs created plus of -6. Jonah Carey, name that player.
Is that Didi Gregorius?
You got him. Bang on. Nice. That's amazing. Is that an illustration of baseball that we should take to heart?
It's an illustration of baseball. It's an illustration that what we see can fool us, and we get excited about things. And we really get excited about the beginning of the season and the postseason. We make sweeping generalizations based on something that happens early because we say, well, we don't have any other evidence this year, so this guy must have turned a corner, or the, you know, the protein shakes that he had in the offseason have paid off or whatever. And in the postseason, we say, well, this guy is either a choker or a stud based on what he did when the lights shone the brightest. And that's just not how it works. We love to have those narratives. You know, even bats people, we get into this because we like the sport. We like success. You know, we dread failure, and so we watch all this stuff. But, you know, the real, if you really want to understand the answers, it requires years and years of data. But it's funny because we require years of data, but yet we have the ability to measure these micro things, these Josh Donaldson moved in two steps and therefore. So it's just, the more data we have, the more we have to be almost disciplined in how we use it, because we can let ourselves get carried away. We can say, well, now we can measure stuff better, so now we know that on April 17th this is happening. No, we don't. We don't know anything. I don't care how many barrels or exit velocity digits you have or positioning or whatever. It's still a sample size issue, just like life. You know, something happens a couple of times. You flip it heads a couple of times. It's not a loaded coin. It's 50-50. It's just come up a certain way.
Not for nothing, but it just occurred to me that being able to hide behind needing large sample sizes would have been a really nice thing for MLB to think of when they realized that the ball was different. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much time they needed or how many batted balls or fly balls you needed to scientifically say, hey, this is worth a study or this is a meaningful case. But it seems really, it seems anti-Rob Manfred, at least in the way he's kind of understood the larger issues of statistics, that it would have been okay for them to go, hey, the ball might have changed and we're going to look into this, but we don't know whether we're right or not. And I guess it's weird that you and I and third-party baseball researchers are willing to lean into this. We don't know yet. It takes time, but baseball itself is not.
Well, here's the difference, though. How many balls have been hit at Kyle Schwarber this year? Didi Gregorius is one player. So we're talking about a few outcomes. When you talk about batted balls for the whole sport, you don't need that long, buddy. You don't need multiple years. It's every guy who comes to the plate in every game. You should be able to start formulating some opinions at least after a couple of months, I would think. You know, it's really not the same thing. And when you look sport-wide, right, like if you look at something like batting average on balls in play, typically the league average is in the, you know, in the 290s, 293, 294, whatever. If you go back and look at what it was on April 5th versus what it's going to be on September 5th, it's going to be the same. It doesn't matter because you've got so many guys adding to the population base. So that argument falls flat just because the sample is there, that even though the amount of time is not there, it's every player and every single game. Kyle Schwarber on one line drive to left, excuse the numbers.
We're talking with Jonah Carey of CBSSports.com and the Bernstein McKnight Show on The Score. Forget the contract numbers for a second and just look at Hanley Ramirez, the player who was DFA'd by the Boston Red Sox. Is he a fit anywhere for anybody hoping for a late career dead cat bounce?
Yeah, I would think that he would, you know, DH would make the most sense. The issue is that some of the teams that would, you know, be most likely, first of all, if you're talking an American League team, okay, so that's going to be limited because there are certain teams that are just tanking. So now you're down to like five or six clubs. The Red Sox would have been one of them, but they're out. You know, maybe the Astros is a possibility because Evan Gattis is not all that good, but they've got a kid named J.D. Davis who they just called up who, you know, right now he's going to play in the field, but as soon as everybody's healthy, he should be their DH. He was hit like 450 in the minors. So, you know, that's not necessarily going to work. The Yankees don't necessarily need a bat, so that's not an issue. Maybe Cleveland. You know, you really can start to count on one hand the teams that are contending can deal with a guy who's not going to play any defense probably, and are willing to give this guy a shot, and he's a better option than what they have. You know, it's not like Mitch Moreland is a Triple Crown winner, but he's pretty darn good against right-handers, and that's good enough. So it's just going to get dicey. I almost want to say that if the Blue Jays were like four games better than the standings, they would be the team, because Kendrys Morales is like the worst hitter in the history of the world. But other than that, I mean, you know, there's just not that many teams that are up there.
Jonah, on the south side, we saw Lucas Giolito struggle with walks for another start, and it's starting to get, it has gotten to a point where it's almost uncontrollable for him. Do we know anything about whether or not, are there statistical markers that say, hey, a send down to AAA and bring back up is now viable for this player? Or in your opinion and in your expertise, does that have to be relied on as far as a coaching standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, typically something the player works out and then he's coached along. I mean, one of the example in Major League history is Randy Johnson, right? Randy Johnson, yeah. Heck, I mean, he was a Montreal Expos prospect once upon a time. He comes up in the majors. He's throwing 97, 98, just like everybody expected. He's got the fastball and slider, but he can't find the broadside of a barn. He ends up getting traded to Seattle, and that doesn't work right away, and he's trying to figure it out. And, you know, the story goes that he got together with Tom House, who was a pitching expert, and also with Nolan Ryan. And Nolan Ryan was the other guy. Nolan Ryan, you know, spit hot fire, but struggled with command, and it took him a while to figure that out. And sometimes you just need the player to have multiple levels of exposure to guys who can teach him, whether it's a player who's been through the trenches and understands what happened, or a coach who can really tweak the mechanics the way the House is legendary at that stuff could. So, you know, Giolito, same kind of thing, right? It's one heavy fastball and it's one hammer-breaking ball. the other stuff doesn't even matter that much. Those are the two main offerings. And how do you harness that? He's got this stuff. We know that he does. We know that it's not systemic because we see Ronaldo Lopez, who granted has been inconsistent, but it's not like it's a curse of White Sox young pitchers, because Lopez, especially last time out, absolutely masterful, not just in velocity or whatever, but in command. So we know that it's a possibility, but it might be that he's going to need some time, and that maybe the combination of, you know, faulty mechanics or whatever with, frankly, lack of confidence. I don't dismiss the mental part of the game. Maybe Giolito just isn't well-suited to try to work this stuff out under the glare of Yankee Stadium or whatever. Maybe he goes to the minors. Maybe even Phantom DL the guy and you have him work on it for a while. I think all those things should be on the table, especially for a team that's not going anywhere this year. Giolito is, you know, if they're going to succeed, he would potentially play a big part. So, yeah, why not put him on the side for a little bit? I wouldn't object to that. I don't think that going back to the minors or finding a way to have him work on the side for a few weeks or whatever is the worst outcome here.
Theo Epstein just earlier today here at the ballpark emphatically denied the existence of any trade talks in which the Cubs are currently engaged. He seems a bit put out by what he called a spasm of media attention regarding Manny Machado, and it's only because Machado happened to be in the city at the other ballpark, and all the media went down to talk to him, and he humored them, and despite a couple of reports, I want to say John Heyman and a couple others had linked the Cubs to Manny Machado, and Theo found the whole thing ridiculous. Still, we know Machado's going to get traded, and there are some who continue to say it's better to do it sooner rather than later so you can get more games of him for whatever the rental fee is going to be. Another report said all of these descriptions of potential trade packages are way outsized, that people are way overestimating what the cost is going to be. And then some are saying, look, as you get closer, all it takes is two teams to bid up that rental cost. How do you see the market developing, both in how and how big and when?
I think this puts aside the fact that we're dealing with both a buyer and a seller. And the seller in this case, or the potential seller, is one of the most obstinate ownership groups in all of sports. You know, the Angelos family is just ridiculously stubborn and sometimes, frankly, dumb based on what they do. You know, they've been so obsessed with this whole TV argument that's going on with the Nationals. When the Nationals moved from Canada to Washington, D.C., there became this kind of long-term adjustable TV deal that makes a huge difference in how the Orioles view finances. So the end result is they don't go out and spend money on anybody. And that's part of it, so that they're so obsessed with the bottom line there. And then they're just so... it's like this gridlock, because you've got Dan Duquette, who's the GM, but then Buck Showalter wields outsized influence, and he might not want to get rid of guys on the major league roster for whatever reason, because maybe he's got a short-sighted view. And ownership is going to step in. So, you know, do we know that Manny Machado is going to get traded? Are you sure that Manny Machado is going to get traded? I think he will. I agree that whoever gets him should try to get him in May as opposed to July 31st. I just don't trust the Orioles to make the right decision. I'm not 100% positive that Manny Machado doesn't play the last game of the season as a member of the Baltimore Orioles. I could see that happening. It's insane to say that, but I could see that happening because there's just so much gridlock in Baltimore.
Jonah, I agree with you. I don't trust the Orioles to do the right thing. Appreciate you hanging out, my man.
Thanks, fellas.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.